Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. And momentarily, I'll be joined by my co-host, Peter Fowler. He'll be joining us live from Parts Unknown. And in studio, I have a local activist, Andrea Zamudio. She's in the studio right now, and she'll be chiming in on the dialogue. She's a very strong activist for immigrant rights in this country, and you know, we will perhaps talk about some issues, you know, associated to around that. But as you know, if you're joining us right now, you see the title of the program, and you know, it's certainly around the so-called Christmas holiday. It's bastardization, and what I mean by bastardization, you know, it has very little of a fathered past, so we're gonna delve into the Christian holiday, you know, in America, specifically, you know, targeting United States of so-called America, and looking at how this holiest day of the year for Christians is celebrated and promulgated throughout the country, and certainly this doesn't mean that every Christian in this country celebrates Christianity this way, but it is probably by far, you know, the biggest money making holiday of the year, or one of the biggest money making holidays of the year. A lot of attention placed towards good old Saint Nick, Kris Kringle, Santa Claus, whatever you want to call him, and you know, not too many critical thinkers would dispute the fact that most, you know, Christian households that have children under the age of 12 or 10, you know, would dispute the fact that most of those children know much more about Santa Claus and receiving gifts and the expectation of that than they do of so-called shedding, you know, goodwill and goodwill to all mankind and all the things that are put, you know, pushed around on Christmas that you know, Christians are supposed to be doing, you know. So we're gonna be getting into a lot of stuff, but I want to start off the show first and foremost because there's a big push, you know, as you know, or you may not know, a few months ago we did a program around the Scott sisters, and you know, they are the two sisters in Mississippi who have been imprisoned for 16 years. And they're facing, you know, been facing hell. Jamie has renal failure, means that, you know, her kidney is failing. She needs medical support, and they're basically serving two life sentences apiece for an alleged $11 robbery. And so I want to read this to you loud and clear. And if you're listening live and you don't get all the information, make sure that you rewind it later and write down the information and contact the people that I'm going to, and the numbers and email the folks so that we can bring justice to the Scott sisters. So whether the Scott sisters are innocent or guilty, any reasonable person can see that the punishment that they received does not fit the crime. In addition, Jamie Scott is very ill and suffering from stage 5 renal failure. That's kidney failure. Currently, it's up to the Mississippi Governor, Haley Barbour, to commute their sentences and pardon them. Each sister is currently serving a double life sentence for an $11 robbery. That's four life sentences between the two sisters. To date, the sisters have been in prison for 16 years. Please, please let Governor Haley Barbour know that you are seeking justice for the Scott sisters now. For more information or contact information for Governor Barbour is P.O. Box 139. That's P.O. Box 139. That's in Jackson, Mississippi. Area code 392051. And the number to call there is 877-405-0733. That's 877-405-0733. And if you want to email him, I'm going to give you the email, his email, and also his personal assistance email. Please blitz his email. Fill up his email. Fill up his assistance email. It's governor@governor.state, www.mrs.ms.us. And the email for his personal assistant, her name is Dorothy Q Kendall, and her email is dkuykendall@governor.state.ms.us. And one last time, it's dkuykendall@governor.state.ms.us. Please contact, like I said, email them, call them, get your friends, your networks. This is very, very important. All right, so without further ado, we're going to get this show started, and you're welcome to call in. The call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. At any point you want to call in and contribute to the show, please do. This is community radio. It's for all of us, all of us. So we're going to start off with this clip from Dr. Barrett Shango. And I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with his work. The late, great Ishakamusu Barrett Shango, Ishakamusu Barrett Shango. And I'm going to play this clip that he had in terms of a speech that he gave a while ago on Christmas. So just listen to this, and we'll be joined on the other end by Peter and Andrea. We'll get going.
White suit and wearing puffy face white man. Be a representative of a one and the same of the Christ child born over in a hot land in Palestine, a black boy in a manger in a state. Who eventually was assassinated for rebelling against the Roman government. Where's the connection? But here's the foolishness of it. I don't mean to sound arrogant or anything, but it just sounds foolish to me. Look, these young people are coming to me with this and to us with this. Now, either you're going to deal with reality with them or you're going to lose them altogether. But these fantasies are not going to keep it. They may have worked for you in your time because you didn't know any better. God winked on your ignorance because you didn't know no better. But now the door has been opened. The light is here. And if you fight against it, you fight against yourself. You prick against yourself in fighting against it. I'm not trying to convert you to anything. I'm not trying to get you to join anything but yourself. I want you to do your own thinking. And you can't do your own thinking unless you know this as well as that. Then you got some information you can work with in your brain computer. Other than that, you'll be walking around supporting their system and keeping them going from now on. That's why God will have to kill you with them too, because you won't let go. So he's going to get them. He and she going to get them. Ain't no doubt about that in my mind. I might not be allowed to see it, but they're going to get got. The law of karma is an immutable law. What goes around comes around. Never fails. All you got to do is study history and you will see that. Now, here's the thing that shows the insanity that we have come into since we've been captivated here. You work hard to get money, and you got to do it. You're compelled to do it. It's a sin against God if you don't do it. You offend the baby Jesus if you don't do it. Get this money. I've got to get this white man this money. And he puts you in a state of panic and hysteria. There's only 20 days left to Christmas. Only 15 days left to Christmas. And he come at you through your babies. Because you know, black folks don't like to deny their babies nothing. It's hard to say no to your babies. And they lacking so much in the world today anyway, so you figure at least I can give them this little bit of something. I know what you're thinking now. Let me ask you something, though. How in the name of heaven do you do all this? You got to work hard, two and three extra jobs, and wrapping packages and maintenance and stuff. Spending money you ain't got. Wait till the babies go to sleep at night. And here you go with your fool self. Shit, get them out. Somewhere. They wake up the next morning, their eyes all bright, looking at stuff around the tree. Come here, baby, look what Santa Claus sent down for you. Now, you can do what you want. Ain't no way in the world I'm going to work my butt off. Buy something for my children and tell them some white man did. But here's a part of the mental genocide of that. You lied to your child for 10, 12 years. You may think that's a light thing, but it isn't. You have your child believing in something, and I mean we believe in it. I was hurt. I cried for 2 days when they told me it wasn't no Santa Claus. I cried, man. How can my mama, who's a beautiful woman, who loved me and worked hard, working in white folks' house, washing their clothes, ironing their clothes, and putting their clothes and dying, take care of me? How can she lie to me like that? And it establishes, if the child is not conscious, it establishes subconsciously a distrust. Time is running out. It establishes a distrust. And anything else you say. So now by the time they get to adolescence, you wonder why they don't trust what you say to them. Right, right. You don't lie to them like that. For what? To give white folks the credit? Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to close out on this because I got to say just a little bit about the 4th of July here. Yeah. But I got to say this too. Can I just a minute? I go to prison. I didn't know I had such a, you know, brothers passed books all around the prison. I went down one hall of one prison and was like I was returning a conqueror from victory. All over there, man. Oh, are the brothers in prison be reading the book? And I went to one prison, man, heard all this cheering all over there. Where was they? How they know me? So I get to go and talk to the brothers in the prison lodge. So I'm in the prison talking to brothers. And a lot of them I find got armed robbery charges. And many of those charges fell during the season of the year. So I asked him, I said, brother, what's responsible for that? Why'd you do that? Because most of those crimes are committed against other black people. I said, well, why you do that, brother? He said, well, now look, I'm going to tell you. This is what some of the brothers told me. He said, when your children keep saying that this is Christmas and this new thing coming out and that thing coming out, and your woman keep putting pressure on you about you got to get some money and get some Christmas in here, because I know I can identify with that. That's why I hooked up with the sister I was married, the African American sister. I've been through that. I let some sisters go behind that. And that's before I found out the truth about it. Pressure on me, and I had to get this money. I couldn't get no job. I didn't have no job, so I had to go get it the best way I can. Because when I walk before my children and my woman, I want to look like a man. Now, you done wrapped his manhood up into what he can get you materially from this white man. Look at that. And in counseling with some of the sisters, the wives and girlfriends and things of these men in there, I said, wouldn't it be better for you to have your man home for your children? Wouldn't that be a better Christmas for you than this man to be in jail? Behind these material things aren't going to last. And you know how it goes. Halfway through the day, most of the stuff is torn up, laying in the corner. You look at it and realize you have been living in a fool's paradise, so to get over that, you break out the bottle and have Christmas cheer. And then once you get that alcohol in you and start thinking about you done spend money you don't have, thinking about how you gonna get your rent paid next month or your mortgage paid or feed your babies in January, then you resort to the ritual of busting each other upside the head. You, but when I was coming up, I couldn't figure out why on such a beautiful day, when I had all these toys and it was so lovely, and Santa Claus and Jesus and everybody had come, and everybody was so happy, that a fight always broke out before the day was over. Now I know. Fourth of July, and I'm finished. Yeah, take me a minute on this one. I don't want to take advantage because I know you got other things to do, but 4th of July. Why do I refer to it as the 4th of July? White folks came to me and said, "Black man, if you help me win my freedom from the tyranny of King George, I will give you your freedom." Because every one of those dogs that wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," were either slaveholders or had.
Yes, well, that was Dr. Barashango, and you know, one of the great, you know, scholars. He's an ancestor now, and you know, one of the great African scholars of the time, man, of the past, you know, several decades. And so, you know, props to him for all the great work he did for towards liberating African people worldwide. And he was right on point with what he said, referring to Christmas. I mean, you know, it's just and the relationship Christmas, this Christmas holiday has with Africans, especially Africans within America. So I'm going to join, have Peter Fowler, he's on the line right now. And Peter, if you can once again introduce yourself to the listening audience and you know, give us a couple of your words, you know, on Christmas, and you bring a unique perspective being an individual who went to seminary school and has, you know, served as a pastor for multiple churches. You know, without further ado, you're on.
Thanks, Solomon. It's good to be with you again. And, you know, I do appreciate that because I do have an insider perspective, if you will, on Christmas and on Christianity in general. As you mentioned, I'm a seminary graduate. I was ordained as a minister. But I'm what I consider a recovering Christian. You know, you have recovering alcoholics who no longer are drinking. Well, I'm recovering, but I'm no longer addicted to the drug of Christianity or any other organized religion. So I was on the inside for a long time. As you mentioned, I was a pastor and served in a lot of capacities in the Christian church, and so I have an insider's perspective. So this isn't just, you know, somebody off the street with their rant or with their ideas or their complaints. I have an insider's perspective in terms of the knowledge, the information of a trained professional pastor for many years who attended seminary and was ordained. And so, you know, I come with the perspective of having been on the inside and having studied Christmas and the historical background as a Christian and as a pastor for a long, long time before I relinquished my belief systems, kind of came to my senses, if you will. So I'm looking forward to deconstructing that today from a critical perspective, from a critical analysis perspective, using critical thinking and the historical method and an anthropological method to really take apart Christmas what Christmas means, what Christmas has become in this culture, because as the opening clip demonstrated, kind of in a humorous way, even though there's really nothing funny about the destruction that religion in general and Christianity in particular has wrought across the globe for two millennia, and Christmas is part of that. Christmas is part of that cultural imperialism that is part of the larger hegemonic system or the domination system, as I refer to it, of Euro-American white supremacy and imperialist domination. So that's where I'm coming from, and looking forward to getting into it on Christmas.
Definitely, definitely, and we have some other clips that we're listening to down the line, but I think a good place, a point of departure, would be to examine, you know, and maybe we can, you know, do things the opposite, start from the present and move back. But we look at the present. I was just reading a report that from the National Retail Federation that basically said that consumers plan to spend on average $688.87 this Christmas holiday season. And last year's, it was actually down. It was, less than that. It was $681.83. I think that's very telling, given the fact that we're in a major, major recession. Someone would call it a depression. I would be one of those folks that would call it a depression, especially when you look at, you know, various cities have been in depressions for several years now. Certainly the black community has been in a depression. And I think it's interesting that people, you know, the average consumer is spending $688. I certainly could not spend $688 this holiday season. And so, you know, Peter, when we look at, you know, Christianity, it's to you and I and other like critical thinkers out there, it's inextricably linked to capitalism, consumerism. I mean, that's what I think. When Christmas season comes around, I mean, you know, as Dr. Barashenga was saying, you know, oh my gosh, you know, 20 more days to, you know, 20 more days to Christmas, only 20 more days. And that doesn't mean like 20 more days till I, you know, for me to do some good deeds, for me to, you know, to get out in the community and do X, Y, and Z. I mean, 20 more days for me to buy a certain amount of gifts for individuals, you know, in and outside of my family. I mean, that's what it's based around, and based around also the expectation of receiving material gifts. And
right.
So it's this hypocrisy. That, I mean, this holiday is based on, you turn on the TV, I mean, whether it's even in grocery stores, whether it's Safeway or what have you, whatever grocery stores in your area, they have commercials based around Christmas, getting in. They show the Christmas tree, the pagan symbol, the Christmas tree. Most folks think that, you know, this Christmas tree is some kind of representation of Christ in this time. There was no, there were no fir trees like that, you know, when the character of Christ was Jesus Christ, Yahshua ben Yosef, was even alive, but that's a whole other story we'll get into. But this consumerism, man, how people would spend that kind of money in this kind of economy, where we see joblessness. We see last month only 35,000 jobs, new jobs were added to the economy. They were hoping for 300,000 to 400,000. That's horrendous. That people would feel compelled, and that's the thing, Peter, they feel compelled because the media creates these desires, these material desires and wants, you know what I'm saying? And all it does is it makes Madison Avenue richer, right? Would you say that as well?
Absolutely. You know, there's no question about it, and that's the easiest critique to bring up against Christmas, is that it is so commodified, and it's an easy critique to make because it's so true, it's so self-evident, that Christmas is a buying bonanza for Americans to the extent that another critical thinker, and you probably know, remember the clip that's just given my mind right now, but you know, they talk about how the the purchases that folks are making this Christmas and putting on credit, they won't be paid off by next Christmas. So the $688+, and you know, if you think about it, on average, I mean that's just remarkable, you know, because there's certainly a lot of people who are spending well under that $690 mark. So imagine, you know, folks spending $800, $900, $1,000 and more,
right.
Which is, you know, it's commonplace, you know, and what's the mechanism by which folks purchase things anymore is through credit, you know, and so next December's credit card bills will still reflect this year's Christmas purchases, you know, and that's absolutely scandalous. So the consumerism side of it is by far the easiest critique to take up against Christmas because it's so blatant. To the extent that, I mean, even Christians and even churches take up that argument every year. You know, the Jesus is the reason for the season. You know, that slogan was from Christians, from the Christian side of it, trying to compel their believers, their followers, to get out of the commercial mode, get out of this buying frenzy, get out of this gift-giving frenzy, and remember that, you know, according to their mythology, Jesus is the reason for the season, not Santa Claus, not gifts, not going shopping. But the bottom line, Solomon, is that's what Christmas is. It's what it is in fact. Now, maybe in theory, there's a Christmas a narrative, you know, down underneath all the wrapping paper, if you will. But in fact and in practice, Christmas is a consumer bonanza. And like you said, it's Madison Avenue and all the department stores and all the toy makers and all the restaurants and all these businesses that make a killing this time of year. And it certainly is an American holiday, even for folks who claim no connection to Christianity. There's still the participation in the whole Santa Claus myth and the gift giving and the shopping and the buying and the consumerism end of it. So, irregardless of whether or not we could even think of it as a religious holiday anymore, like I said, there is a religious Christian tradition behind it, but in fact and in practice, it is simply a civil holiday, very much a part of the fabric of Americanism that obviously has nothing to do with Jesus, has nothing to do with the original Christmas story, but has everything to do with shopping, with buying, with consuming, with exchanging gifts, and with all the trappings of Christmas that we see all around us. And one of the, you know, speaking of the trappings of Christmas, and I'll end my comments at this point on this note. The decorations, the holiday decorations that we see all around us. This is my first Christmas season living in Arizona, and I was shocked. And I guess I realize I shouldn't be now, but at first I was shocked when I took a walk just after Thanksgiving. Folks started putting up their Christmas decorations, and even out here in the desert. I mean, this is the Sonoran Desert. You know, it's been 80 degrees out here. And folks have, you know, these snowmen in their front yards. You know, there's snowmen and there's reindeers and there's, you know, Santa Claus with his, you know, with this big, you know, red outfit and, you know, the whole thing, all these trappings of Christmas. And it's just so contradictory and so it just makes no sense whatsoever in this geographic context. But yet still, folks go through those motions because that's just what we do. So that again, that speaks more to the fact that it's a civil holiday that has more to do with consuming and secular traditions that really have nothing whatsoever to do with the Christian religion, which is again a whole separate argument. So.
Right. I mean, it's a very timely, you know, argument. I mean, especially when we're talking about, you know, historically oppressed people within the United States. I'm talking about, you know, indigenous people, Africans, who, you know, by and large, you know, are Christians themselves, you know, within
right.
various sects within Christianity, whether they may be, you know, Catholics, you know, where you see, you know, so many indigenous and Latinos that are Catholic, you know.
Yes.
And looking at, you know, or Baptists or what have you, within the Black community, Methodists, and you look at the origins, Peter, as you know all too well, is that how do these people become Catholic, Roman Catholics, Baptists, what have you, you know, Protestants, whatever, Episcopalian. It was imposed upon them. It wasn't a democratic choice where these white folks, you know, these slaveholders and these murderers, you know, kidnappers, that they said, hey, you know, African people, indigenous people, you know, this is what we practice, you know, and this is what it's about, you know. Would you like to, you know what I'm saying? Would you like to come to our service, you know, this Sunday or whatever day and check out our church? Nah, there was no option. They imposed upon them. They force fed them. And why more pastors that are Black and more priests that are Latino don't talk about this, like, you know, to their congregations, you know, boggles the mind, you know, maybe mm-hmm. because, you know, some of them have become corrupted themselves. When we look at, you know, the folks at the mega churches and the like, I mean, these things were imposed upon them, you know, a Bible in one hand and a sword or a gun in the other hand. It was
right.
imposed upon them. And so, for Black folks, you know, African folks within America to feel like, you know what I'm saying? And I just want to read this. I mean, this little snippet from this great book by Ishaka Musa Barashango. It's African People and European Holidays, A Mental Genocide. I just want to read this because this is so telling, Peter. And so he says, quote, "So I ask you, Black people, what are you celebrating when you celebrate Christmas? Some say they are doing this for the children because it makes them so happy. Then let us put to you another question. Is this what you want your children to be cultivated on, a glorification of images of European culture while neglecting your own? And you wonder why so many Black youths are confused today? Take a good look at what has been done. And what you have given your children to mentally feed upon is at best a carbon copy of white fantasy, which supports capitalist exploitation and keeps Black people under the bondage of Euro-American economic pressures. This is one of the legacies of ignorance, which can only serve to perpetuate the continued mental, spiritual, and oftentimes physical degradation of our youth. Some defend Christmas on the basis that it is a time for cheer, peace, and goodwill, and the giving of gifts to friends and loved ones. Well, I say, consider this. Are you so shallow-minded that you need Madison Avenue to tell you when to love, enjoy, and give gifts to your many loved ones and friends? Would it not be far more intelligent to manifest these acts on holidays that are relevant to your cultural experience, celebrations which practice the values that are necessary for the survival of you, your family, your Black nation and race? Are we respectfully suggest that you take a good look at the new African 7-day celebration of Kwanzaa, which will be discussed in the next chapter." I mean, Peter, he is so on point. You know, if it's what first of all, if you're using this day to give gifts and to spread cheer and goodwill to others, why the hell would you even allow yourself to be constrained to one day? One day, number one, that is not even the birth date of Jesus Christ, Yahshua ben Yosef. And as you know, Peter, who is someone who has read the Bible, there is no mention of any date in the Bible of Jesus Christ's birth. You know what I'm saying? None whatsoever. I wonder why that is. But why would you be so constrained to feel the need to just pick one day, you know what I'm saying, to spread that goodwill? You should be doing it every day in your community. You should be busting your ass every day to spread goodwill in your community, especially if it is a governmentally neglected community, from stolen coast to stolen coast. Would you concur, Peter?
No question about that. And that just reflects another one of the hypocrisies of the Christian tradition, And the quote that you read with regard to instilling Christianity and the belief in the celebration of Christmas into African-American children just, again, demonstrates the fact that, that this is a civil holiday. What it does is it reinforces the Euro-American traditions and belief systems and cultural concepts. And that's why it's so dangerous. And why, you know, why more than anything, you know, non-Euro-American people, people of color, should stay as far away as possible from Christmas and the other Euro-American holidays, because that's what the practice and the celebration and the observation of Christmas does. Is it's part, it's a brick in the wall, another brick in the wall, if you will, that builds up this cultural hegemony that we're talking about. And, you know, it's no small thing. It's a very serious matter when we talk about how this brainwashing occurs, how people are brainwashed into, you know, the Euro-American cultural mores and belief systems and into white supremacy. Well, Christmas is part of that. And so it's just a tremendous contradiction and irony that you have little black boys and little black girls celebrating, being taught to celebrate Christmas in this country, when this country, you know, marks them from birth as targets for annihilation, and so, you know, Christmas is one of those dates that needs to be revealed for what it is, a celebration of Americanism. It's a celebration of Americanism with the thinnest of veneers of religious trappings around it. You know, the Christian story of the birth of Jesus is just kind of a distant rationale for the whole holiday. Obviously, it's something much different. And so, you know, people not connected to that Euro-American cultural tradition need to understand that and to stay as far away from it as possible. And there are alternatives, and, you know, and that's the, as the quote you just read mentioned, we're all well aware of Kwanzaa and other holidays, and but yet still there's definitely a void. There's a lack of non-Euro-American holidays, observations, and holy days on our calendar. And one of the things that my partner Reggie and I are doing at the Academy of Critical Thinking is we're putting together a cultural calendar and a curriculum to go along with it to provide people of color with alternatives to things like Christmas and Thanksgiving and the 4th of July and Columbus Day and these ridiculous, offensive holidays that serve to reinforce the domination and hegemony of white supremacy and that part of their brainwashing into Americanism. So it's definitely a cultural contradiction to see non-white families, whether they're children or grown folks, you know, celebrating Christmas. And it's something that we need to one of the main reasons we need to deconstruct it is to see, you know, what really is going on here and why it is so toxic and so poisonous for people of color to participate in these kind of fraudulent holidays like Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, it's and once again, folks, if anyone wants to call in, you know, during this dialogue, once again, the number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. You can give us your perspective. I am, as Peter said, you know, I was raised a Christian. You know, I was raised a Christian. You know, but one of the greatest gifts that you know, my parents gave me, especially my mom, was despite the fact, you know, that she was raised a Christian herself, you know, is critical thought. And so that critical thought, you know, really allowed me to challenge, you know, any information that was given to me. I wanted the questions. I wanted to know why such and such, why the Christmas tree, why. Well, we never had a Christmas tree in our house. We didn't, you know, that was never part of the Christmas celebration. But I just wanted to know why the Christmas tree? Why, you know, is that one of those, you know, those kind of indelible symbols of Christmas. You know, why all these different things? You know, and the further, more questions I asked, as I, you know, vanguarded through high school and into college, I it was a very rude awakening. It was a rude awakening. What I had come to, kind of what I had understood, you know, was, you know, as I started to pull off the layers, was nothing more than it was a masquerade. It was, it had, you know, when I got to the bottom, it had nothing but dollar signs and even looking into the history. I mean, you know, Christmas trees didn't even start to become used, you know, routinely by Europeans until the 1800s. You know what I'm saying? And the whole Christmas, the whole Christmas holiday. I mean, not the whole, you know, not Christmas, but in terms of the date where people actually think that the 25th represents the birth of Christ. I mean, that was something established by those, you know, 300 plus bishops, you know, that were at the Council of Nicaea in 325, that was going to be established as the birth of Christ. You know what I'm saying? As they were plotting and planning to really take this religion, Christianity, and prophesize it. You know what I'm saying? Prophesize, you know, people, you know, throughout the world. And I have a clip that I want to play real quick. This is Dr. Hagen, and this is interesting. This is the second part of a clip that I wanted folks to hear, but so I'll go in reverse order, and I want to play this, and it's a few minutes, and then I want to get your, after I play this, you know, Peter, since you did go to seminary school, I'd like to pose this question to you, and after the clip, you can speak on it, you know, what this whole Council of Nicaea thing, you know, was,
great.
And why, you know, the date, you know, the 25th, why so many Christians believe that is the date of Jesus Christ's birth and so forth. So here's Dr. Hagen.
The Bible does not give a specific date for Jesus' birth. I wonder why. Think about it. Y'all should go ask some of your family members. What day does the Bible say Jesus was born on? Okay? They vowed. Tell them if they find it for you, you'll buy them a car. The Bible doesn't give a specific date for Jesus' birth, so guess what? Pope Julius I, who was the vicar from 337 to 352, decided that December 25th should be the day of Jesus' birth. Pope Julius. He actually passed the law in the Roman Catholic Church and canonized December 25th as the day of the birth of Jesus Christ. Isn't that deep? Now, what gave him the power to do that? This word right here. Victor. For those who don't know, the word victor means one who stands in the place of God. Okay, that's what victor means. And guess what, y'all? It wasn't just Pope Julius. Every pope is known as the vicar of God. What's the Pope's name now? Present Pope, what's his name? Actually, I'm still thinking John Paul, but they got nothing to say. Y'all don't know? Good. I'm glad y'all don't know. That means you don't really care. That's cool. That's cool. Well, whatever his name is now, he is now the new vicar. Okay, on planet Earth. That's some deep stuff. Because the Pope got the power to stop all wars. All the Pope got to say is every Catholic stop fighting. And every Catholic will lay down their weapon and lead a military. That's power. You know why? Because he's the voice of God on the planet. Whatever the Pope says, that's what is, man. It's great out challenge. Okay, and it was called the Feast of the Nativity, the tradition month, also the year of the Council of Ephesus, where they passed all these laws saying that if you don't believe this, you're anathematized. If you don't believe this, you're anathematized. If you don't believe this, you're anathematized. And at the end of the 8th century, Christmas has stretched so to as far as Scandinavia, where people take part in carnival-like celebrations of giving money to beggars. In England, now this is interesting, Christmas was banned. When Oliver Cromwell and his allies took over the country in 1645, why was it banned? Go do some homework and tell me why. To rid the country of corruption. And to do this, they stopped Christmas. Now that's some deep stuff. They stopped Christmas because they wanted to get corruption out of the country. And when Charles II was restored to the throne, it was reinstated. In the 1620s, guess what, y'all? Christmas was canceled in the United States. And in Boston from 1659 to 1681, it was canceled, stopped. What did these people know about Christmas to cause them to do that? Christmas was totally forbidden. Anyone who was seen celebrating the event was charged 5 shillings. Wow! Then why is it such a celebration now? Who had the 10th stated, and I quote him, "What profit hath not that fable of Christ brought us?" Look at that, y'all. In 1515, the Pope, and again, who is the Pope? The victor of God on the planet. The Pope, what did Pope Leo know that caused him to say, "What profit hath not that fable of Christ brought up?" Now, what he was actually saying was this, y'all. Look at how much money we made from this tale about this figure that we created called Jesus Christ. Look at Creflo Dollar. He can say the same thing. Benny Hinn, he can say the same thing. T.D. Jakes can say the same thing. All of them can say the same thing, man. Look at how much money we have made off of this lie.
Right.
And what's deep about it is people want the lie to exist. People need the lie to exist because they feel like they're going to go to hell if they don't support this lie. And tell you, you're going to hell. Because you don't believe the lie. What you have found to be a lie, you don't believe it, and you're going to hell. Boy, that's some deep stuff. The problem is that the masses do not know the truth that Pope Leo X knew. The Christian faith was the most influential belief system in the Western world for more than 1,000 years. But it's not as healthy today as it was 100 years ago. Wow. Think about it. And guess what, y'all? And I'm glad about this part. Among black people, it's not as healthy today as it was 10 years ago. You know why? Because black folk are starting to think. A lot of our young people went off to college, went off to school, and got into black studies programs. While in college, and they learned stuff at UCLA or at Mizzou or wherever college you went to, and you got into a black studies program and you found out about African culture and the story of the original virgin born Christ child. And then you came back home saying, "But wait a minute, Pastor so-and-so, what about this?" And Pastor so-and-so told that college student, "You don't need to be knowing about that. You can't believe everything you hear. Bible said, and in the latter times, some would depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils." Now, so, what's your college professor's name? Dr. Carango? He's a seducing spirit. Y'all get the picture? What's that preacher you were listening to on the internet? Did you listen to him no more? That's the devil trying to steal your joy. What is it? What's the name of the station? WBLR? Let me write that down so I can pray for you. So they can go home and listen to it. Right? People are realizing that what they've been given is a belief system, check this, y'all, that depends totally on the level of an individual's faith. and not on credibility of sound, factual, historical, and verifiable truth or evidence. In other words, y'all, as you've heard me say this before, I'll say it again. Everybody repeat this after me. Faith
is belief
in unverified thought. See, when I get into discussions with people and then they say this to me, well, let me tell you what I believe. When they say that, conversation comes to an end. Know why? Because I respect that. I respect what you believe. And I'm not going to push you any further because I know you can't prove it. Follow what I'm saying? You can't prove it. That's why it's called belief. If you know something, you don't have to believe it. Y'all with me? What does one do when they find out that communion or the Lord's Supper was not instituted by so-called Jesus, as we've been taught? What do you do, man? Now, y'all know how I did it. See this table right here? Now, I'm not this one, but I stood behind tables like this for years. I think I did it too when I first came here, didn't I?
Yeah.
I stood behind this table right here, and I used to stand behind this table and say, Lord, give me the wisdom to bring our people to right knowledge. Because our people didn't know that they were participating in what is called symbolic cannibalism. We used to pour a little wine, a little grape juice, and a little crackers. You know, and the people, sisters would stand on each end of the table, you know, and they would do their thing. And I'm standing there breaking up the crackers behind this thing, saying, Lord, please give me the wisdom to educate my brothers and my sisters to right knowledge here. That's something. And I'm so glad that many did make that transition. There's Elder Lucas, she's the Elder Walker, Montos, Elder Lee, others who, and then some just couldn't handle it. Some need that little cup.
Peter, one of the things that I take away from that piece the most is the belief, is that, and I've noticed this, you know, I've engaged in different debates and dialogues, as I know you have as well. We've had these conversations ourselves, you know, about past debates that we've engaged in with other Christians. And when you bring up the stuff, their belief is so strong that they just eschew they any kind of factual basis that you try to provide them, and then, you know, with the historical reference in black and white, you know, and specifically telling them, you know, in their own holy book, where the misconception that they have, you know, can be found, that it's, you know, totally not what it says, you know, in the Bible, and then even, like, you know, referencing things that are so-called in the Bible and how they don't mesh up with, you know, day-to-day practices that go on, you know, amongst their congregation and their church. Their belief is so strong, Peter, that I believe that it's all, there's a psychological condition for that, is that people that, you know, when people have such a strong belief or faith in something, that that it comes to a point where they just totally ignore a rational and historical and a factual counter to that, as if it was, you know what I'm saying, as if it, like, that, you know, that which can be proved is actually wrong. And I don't know if you you know, had these conversations recently, but if you can you know, shed some, you know, some light on that, and also, like, where do we get these you know, these strong beliefs, Peter? Where do these beliefs and these misconceptions that so many Christians have about, you know, holidays such as, you know, Easter's another one, and Easter's another, I would say, another, you know, obviously it's a commercialized holiday, it's been commodified, and also a misconceived holiday in terms of what people, you know, think it means in terms of the resurrection and so forth. But, you know, Peter, where does this come from, and why don't more pastors like yourself, like Dr. Ray Higgins, why don't they introduce that into the church? Is there a bigger conspiracy behind it? Is there something that they're trying to continue to perpetuate? I think there is, but I'd like to get your opinion or your perspective.
okay, there's a lot to unpack there, and you know, the first answer your question about the psychological condition, because you referred to a very specific condition, the reality where people have fixed beliefs that are based on things that are not based in reality, that are not based in fact. There is a name for that. There is a psychological condition, and it's called delusional. All right, and see, in all seriousness, I do believe that Christians are delusional, and Christians are not the only people that are delusional. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not just picking on Christians here, but since Christmas is our topic, let's do that for just a minute, because now keep in mind now that American Christianity is under the umbrella of Americanism, so we can't talk about Christmas as we understand it, as we see it, the thing that we know of as Christmas, right here, right now. We can't talk about that thing outside of the context of Americanism, because Christmas as we know it is very much a product of Americanism, of American ideology, of American ways of thinking, of American cultural mores, of American ideals. Okay, so the delusion is not unique to Christians, okay? It's part of the delusion, the broader delusion of Americanism, because there's a lot of Americans out there, I dare say, you know, the majority of Americans who believe things that just are not true, okay? Whether it's about holidays or whether it's about the economy, about economics, about politics, you know, and these are matters of fact. I'm not just making up comments out of thin air. Even though now's not our time to talk about them, but let's talk for a minute about some of the mythology and some of the untruths that make up this thing called Christmas. One of the things that Dr. Hagen mentioned, and you know, for our listeners who haven't heard Dr. Hagen before, you know, that clip is just kind of an appetizer. There's a lot of Dr. Hagen's available online. He's exceptionally informative. So I commend him to all our listeners. So I go check out Dr. Ray Hagen's on YouTube and listen to some more of what he has to say, because he breaks it down in a tremendously informative and down-to-earth fashion. But at any rate, one of the things he mentioned was the date of Christmas. You know, and where does this December 25 come in? I mean, you know, it's not in the Bible. It's clearly not in the Bible. So this thing of this date, you know, we've settled on this date of 25 December as being the date that Jesus was born. And that's not based in any kind of fact, any kind of reality, any kind of historical fact, any kind of tradition outside of pagan religious observations. And that's easily traceable. You know, it's a matter of fact that the Roman holiday Saturnalia and that a number of all kinds of non-Western cultures had celebrations around the winter solstice, and that's coming up next Tuesday, and that's what I'll be celebrating. That's what I celebrate this time of year is the winter solstice. I don't celebrate Christmas anymore, but I celebrate something that's based in fact, based in reality, which is the solstice. And so there were a number of pagan cultures, and let's clarify what pagan means too. Pagan simply is a reference to local gods. So, you know, a group or a clan or a tribe that lived in one area, they had their gods, and they didn't believe in the gods of the people that lived on the other end of the continent. And so they were pagan because they believed in those local gods. There was no universal gods a long, long time ago. I mean, that's a relatively new phenomenon anthropologically. You know, it's this idea of monotheism and everybody believing in one God. That's one of the things that Christianity tries to do, is try to unite everybody under the flag of monotheism and Christianity. And so what that does is it creates uniformity, okay? And that's a form of control. So, you know, December 25th was a date that was already being celebrated widely throughout the Roman Empire. And now keep in mind, the Roman Empire is the context in which Christianity in general, on the Christmas holiday in particular, started to generate. And so we have to have some understanding of that historical context. So all across the Roman Empire, different groups of people are celebrating something in, you know, the around the solstice, around the 25th of December or on the 25th of December, like Saturnalia, and the solstice being on the 21st or the 22nd. So there were a lot of celebrations already going on. And so the Christian church simply adopted the 25th of December because it was an expedient way to simply plug Christmas in to the culture that was already there. And so that's how we come up with December 25th. It's not rooted in anything historical or anything scriptural. You know, there's a whole host of things, Solomon, that aren't rooted in anything scriptural around Christmas. One of the things, this is kind of it's funny to me at least. Every time I would teach Bible study, and we'd get to, you know, the Christmas narratives, I would ask folks in my class, I'd say, how many wise men were there? And, you know, uniformly, the answer is three, right? There's three wise men. I mean, you know, just look out your window at the nativity scenes or, you know, the nativity scenes that are just ubiquitous this time of year. And there's what? There's how many? Three. There's three wise men. Well, I would challenge my classes to show me where it says that in the Bible. Well, it doesn't say that anywhere. The reference in the Bible is magi, all right, which is plural for magus. And magus is loosely translated to be a wise man. They were like an astronomer or an astrologer, a philosopher. You know, they were these wise and learned people of some of the Eastern traditions. And it's simply plural. It's like saying men. So if I were to say there were two men, does that mean three? No, it just means more than one. You know, so yet and still we have this constant, this number never varies. In all the scenes that you see, it's constant. And what's right along with them? What's right along with the magi or the wise men and these nativity saints? Well, the shepherds, right? And, well, you know, the thing is, you know, these are different stories being conflated. You know, there's four Gospels, and in Matthew and in Luke, you know, we have these two birth narratives where there's magi in one, and there's shepherds, and they're two totally different stories. Yet still, they're conflated into one story because that's the only way that we can make a nativity scene, right? Or that's the only way we can make a movie is to conflate it into one easily digestible piece, you know. And so, you know, you read one story and there's magi in it, but there's no shepherds, you know. There's no angels, and then but yet still we have this conflated picture in our minds where there's angels and there's shepherds and there's magi, three magi, you know, all these things, and it's all made up, it's all make believe, and when I say it's all make believe, I mean that literally, all right. Not only are the stories conflated, and so, you know, this picture every time you look at a nativity scene, the inaccuracies abound. But literally, the story itself is a fallacy. The story was concocted for political reasons. All right, the whole story behind the virgin birth and the wise men coming to adore the baby Jesus, all these things were developed much, much later, much after Jesus, the historical Jesus, was born. The historical Jesus was a peasant. He was born to peasant parents who were nobodies. They were no names, which is why we don't know what day he was born on, because he was a nobody. His parents were nobodies, all right? They didn't keep track of where nobodies lived or when nobodies were born, okay? Those people were the underclass of society. They were the untouchables, and that's who the historical Jesus was. So that's why nobody knows when he was born. There was no record of it, and so the stories that we find in the Bible were constructed and fabricated much, much later, decades after the fact. And they were constructed to follow, and Dr. Higgins talks about this much better than I can in some of his clips online, so check them out. But the story about that became the Jesus narrative of what we find in the Bible was very carefully crafted, was kind of cobbled together, so to speak, from a number of other traditions around the Roman Empire and around the Mediterranean basin and around Mesopotamia and from Africa. All these bits and pieces of the Jesus story were cobbled together to create the story of Jesus. And it wasn't until the year 325, and this is something Dr. Higgins talks about too, with this Council of Nicaea, the point at which Christianity becomes Christianity. You know, this little illegal religion, this little ragtag band of followers of the historical Jesus, they become very politically significant in the early 4th century, Christianity becomes a major political player. It becomes the big boy, actually, at one point when it's made the official religion of the Roman Empire. And so when it becomes that, Solomon, that is the point at which, for political reasons, these theological explanations are fabricated and imposed upon the culture, imposed at this time throughout the Roman Empire. These are things that people were forced to believe. These are things that people were told to believe, much the way we're told to believe things today, like the haters for our freedoms, and you know the terrorists want to destroy
right.
America because you know the story. It's just this fabrication, but that's what we're told to believe in order to be good patriotic Americans. These are the things that we need to believe, and these are the stories that we need to buy into. And so that's what the Roman Empire was doing with Christianity. It became almost in a sense, Solomon, a cultural glue that kind of held the empire together, and it allowed the empire to exercise control through means of religion. All right, there's a whole lot obviously to that statement, and it would take us a long time to unpack that. But let's leave it at that, and let's jump ahead to the 21st century. And the same thing is going on now. That you know the same hegemonic domination system is now manifest in the United States of America. And so Americanism needs a narrative that people believe, that people buy into freely, as a sort of cultural glue that holds everything together. All right, and there's a lot of narratives out there, you know, and Christmas is one of the bigger ones, and obviously this time of year is when that gets resurrected, okay, so to speak, every year around this time, and we go through it again and again and again, and it's one of the ways that cultural cohesion is imposed upon people. And so that's what we need to understand is going on. And again, to go back to some of our earlier comments, why it is so important for non-white people and everyone who is opposed to the domination system to not participate in any of these the whole Christmas nonsense. Non-participation is important as a way to not be brainwashed and to not be. Have these values and these beliefs imposed upon us. So I know I kind of went off in a different direction there, but I hope I got close to answering your question.
Why
some of these things are developed.
Better to go off on a tangent that's rooted in critical thought and some kind of factual basis than to say something, you know, very cursory and, you know, to what you think is a point, but it, you know, really is not a point. So, you know, no, I appreciate that broad context that you brought to the discussion, and you said something that was like, you know, that really caught my mind's eye, and that was is that especially looking at people of color, like oppressed people within the U.S. and indigenous people, you know, people of African ancestry. Yes, it was imposed upon us, you know what I'm saying, Christianity,
right.
and for that matter, a ton of Western values. But the real issue is that there's a couple of things. Now, people don't know. It's one thing not to know. Everyone, the most intelligent people know how vastly ignorant they are, and because they know that, they are consistently trying to pursue that knowledge so that they can become less ignorant, you know what I'm saying, and that's a lifetime process because no one can know everything within their lives, but they can continue to pursue. But it's another thing to not know that you don't know and to walk around. And there's a lot of people that don't know that they don't know. And then the next step is they can't, you know, they have no historical basis to even, I mean, these things have been such a part of their history that they can't even trace. You know, if you ask them, like, you know, well, why do you practice this? Why has this become your value? Why are you so stuck? You know what I'm saying? Why are you so much stuck in this quagmire, this like mental dogmatic quagmire, to move away from this value system or these practices, to even look at other things, to even embrace some of the precepts of Kwanzaa? Fine, you don't have to practice Kwanzaa, but let's look at some of the, you know, a couple of the seven principles of Kwanzaa. Why is it so difficult to get you to move away from that? And there's folks that just they just can't answer that question. They're just stuck in, they're basically, you know, slaves to habit. You know what I'm saying? They're just slaves to habit, and they're stuck in it. And so going out every Black Friday, waking up at, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning to be at the department store at 4 o'clock in the morning, and to wait till they open the door, and to run in there like a bunch of wild animals, sometimes trampling people to death, just to go in there to fight over a flat screen TV. You know what I'm saying? It's mind boggling, Peter. And when you even look at, let's look at just Ujoma, you know, in Kwanzaa, you know, which is the practice of cooperative economics. You know, and it says, you know, means cooperative economics, and by is the fourth day of Kwanzaa, and on this day of Kwanzaa we pledge to develop our own businesses and to support them, to maintain shops, stores, and industry that contribute to the well-being of our community, and to drive out businesses, boycott, etc., that take from our communities and give back. Now, last year, the Black community spent over $700 billion, and yes, much of that was credit they don't have, and 94-95% of that figure that I just put out there was going to white businesses and white communities, businesses that you know, that take from your community. The people are not spending those dollars that they make in your community they're taking them to whatever suburbia, you know what I'm saying, area that their families are from, you know, and they're going to be spent there. They're going to be spent on, you know, their children's trust funds, or they're going to be invested into somebody's hedge funds, or they're going to, you know, and it, you know, so that's why Kwanzaa is not, you know, it's not like, but just critically, Peter, that is so much of what is needed. That is, you know what I'm saying, just looking at Ujoma, that is so important for the Black community to look at that cooperative economics. But these values, and I'm glad you mentioned the 21st century, that we, you know, that we, as people of color, have accepted these value systems, based these Eurocentric value systems, and we have no idea. So they're basically bastardized values. So they have no idea where they came from. We just accept them, and we will argue. People who are literally trying to get us to think more progressively will argue to the end, like, why we support them, why we say we support the troops, why we this, that, and the other, why we support, you know, going and buying, you know, and toasting, you know, I gotta have some liquor on Christmas Day, I gotta drink, and I wanted this. There's a speech that Frederick Douglass gave in 1882. We definitely know about the speech he gave in Rochester around 4th of July. Now this is going to blow people's minds. I just want to read this little segment of this speech that Frederick Douglass gave in 1882, and it related to his experiences as a slave during Christmas time. So he was hearkening back to his experiences as a slave during the Christmas season. Peter, and everyone that's listening, tell me this doesn't make sense. Tell me this does not make sense. Even in 21st century America. Quote, the days between Christmas Day and New Year's were allowed the slaves as holidays. During these days, all regular work was suspended, and there was nothing to do but keep fires and look after stock. We regarded this time as our own by the grace of our masters, and we, therefore, used it or abused it as we pleased. The holidays were variously spent. The sober, industrious ones employ themselves in manufacturing corn brooms, mats, horse collars, and baskets, and some of these were very well made. Another class spent their time hunting possums, coons, rabbits, and other game. But the majority spent the holidays in sports, ball playing, wrestling, boxing, running, foot races, dancing and drinking whiskey, and the latter, being whiskey, mode was generally most agreeable to their masters. A slave who would work during the holidays was thought by his master undeserving of holidays. There was, in this simple act of continued work, an accusation against slaves, and a slave could not help thinking that if he made $3 during the holidays, that he might make $300 during the year. Finally, not to be drunk during the holidays was regarded by the slave master to the slave was disgraceful. So if you were a slave and you were not drunk during the holidays, your master thought that it was disgraceful. Peter, you can't tell me, no one listening right now cannot tell me that if you, as a African man, African woman in America, you decide to do something outside of, and you take a stance in terms of outside of doing something outside of the value system, the common value systems that are associated with Christmas. That is what they want you to do. What did the mental midget George Bush say after one of the first things he said after 9/11? He said, "Go out and spend some money. Go out and shop.
Right. Go out and
not go into your community and build with your community, comfort one another, this, that, and the other. Shop." Because they don't want you to build with your community members. They don't want you to think and have discussions and to think and delve into, like, why the frig did this happen here and go to the root of it. Well, wow. Shoot, I didn't know that some of the U.S.'s foreign policy actions of the past contributed to 9/11. And it's something deemed by the CIA itself called blowback, and was mentioned by Chalmers Johnson, mentioned in Tom Wiener's book Legacy of Ashes, the term blowback, that the U.S., you know, when it continues to agitate and do nefarious things outside of the U.S. in other countries, that they expect for a segment of that population that has been abused and manipulated, and in a lot of cases killed by U.S. foreign policy, that segment is going to wish to retaliate in the same way that the U.S. retaliated in Afghanistan, and killed more civilians on their initial airstrikes in Afghanistan than the civilians that were killed on 9/11. You know what I'm saying? But that was not called terrorism. That was called retaliation. That was, and those lives that were civilian that died, that was collateral damage. And Americans from sea to shining sea, as you know, Peter, they were bloodthirsty. They had no qualms about it. You know, outside the progressive folks, the vast majority of folks said, "Get them, go get them." And then when they lied about Saddam Hussein being connected to it, they said, "Get them, go in there and bomb them, whatever it takes. Turn Iraq into a parking lot if you have to." And so this Christmas season, this 25th of December, Peter, I ask you, how many Americans, how many so-called Christian Americans sitting around the table watching football and watching the Lakers play the Miami Heat and sitting around and toasting, how many of them will think about the million-plus Iraqi civilians that have been killed because of the U.S. and NATO forces bombing them to oblivion? How many of them will think about the tens of thousands Afghani civilians that have been killed by airstrikes? The answer is not too many.
Right.
I don't know how many, but right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I want to Just put a question out there, and I'm going to answer it. What does all that have to do with Christmas? It has everything to do with Christmas. What you did was you broadened the context of what we're talking about in terms of, historically, going back to Frederick Douglass and some of the things he was talking about with the contradictions and the hypocrisy of white supremacy is they're boundless, and that story from Frederick Douglass points that out. I mean, think about it. What is one of the stereotypes of, well, even of slaves? You know, going back to slavery, the slaves were what? They were lazy, they were shiftless, and that whole stereotype carried over after slavery was abolished. You know, and you know, black folks forever have been considered to be, you know, lazy and shiftless and don't want to work. And you know, Ronald Reagan used that whole welfare queen stereotype. You know, he milked that. Now, yet and still, okay. So there's that stereotype. But there were a number of slaves, as Douglass attests to, who spent their week of their holiday week, their vacation, spent it working, you know, making things and selling things and making money and you know, getting up early and burning the midnight oil and what was the master's response to that? They were disparaged for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were being productive, and they were being industrious, and that brought the wrath of the slave master down on them. So I mean, again, it just points out a tremendous hypocrisy and a tremendous contradiction. Now, and then we moving forward in terms of the events that are going on now geopolitically, in terms of the wars and what's going on in by the United States government in terms of perpetrating wars all over the world, but as Americans, and this is at the root of it. You know, we're not enculturated, we're not socialized, we're not taught to think, period, much less think globally, and to think about what our government, what our country is doing. In terms of imperialism and colonialism and fascism, we're taught to what? To go shopping, like you said. That was Bush's admonition, or his advice to folks, was go shopping. You know, don't worry, don't think about what went on, don't try to solve this issue. Go shopping, right? We're taught that, you know, because, and that goes back to two of the cardinal virtues of Americanism: individualism and materialism.
Yeah.
Right? Go shopping, celebrating Christmas, and individualism and materialism. And that's
right.
Why non-participation in Christmas is so important, because what that does is it says, no, I refuse to participate in individualism and in materialism. We've got to learn to think differently. You talk
right.
About how African people, after they were kidnapped and brought to this continent and other continents as well, and the islands and so forth, but particularly here, into what developed in the United States, and how, you know, their indigenous religions and cultures were stripped from them. I mean, just you know, just rigorously stripped from them, purged. They were purged of their religion and their culture and their language and their names, and so on and so forth. You know, and the religious piece is significant, particularly in this conversation for Christmas. So you know, so several generations later, what you have is you have a people who have been forcibly removed from their cultural tradition and from their cultural memory and from their families. And so then Christianity is imposed upon them. They're allowed to learn about Christianity. They're told to learn about Christianity. They're taught to participate in Christmas and things like that. And so you have a people who don't have any options in front of them in terms of fulfilling their spiritual desires. Christianity is the only thing out there, and so that's where, you know, black Christianity develops, and that's where the black church develops in this country. And we need to take a long look at the disconnect between African spirituality and indigenous religions and Christianity, because they're totally incongruous, they're totally incompatible. We're talking about Christianity particularly as an extension of Americanism, or as a component of Americanism, and that by definition is about individualism, about materialism, and about xenophobia, and about commodification and capitalism and all those things and hierarchy.
Right.
And a male-dominated society, and all those things are foreign, totally foreign,
right,
to the African people who came over, who were brought over to this country, forcibly brought over to this country. All those concepts are foreign to African people, their descendants, and to African Americans even today. So, you know, it's this nonsensical holiday, particularly for people who are not of, you know, the European cultural tradition. And so we need to step back and take a look at that and say, what's really going on here, not from a religious perspective, but from a cultural perspective, from an anthropological perspective, and understand that Christmas is one of the tools of control used by white supremacy and by the Euro-American domination system. And so particularly for people of color, it's time to step away from that tradition and to look back to some indigenous religious impulses, and Kwanzaa is a phenomenal place to start. It really is. It's a phenomenal place to start, and I encourage folks to look into that, participate in it, and do some research on your own. You know, find out what else is out there, because there are other
right.
things out.
Exactly, and I mean, you know, Peter and I say this every time, man. If you're listening and you want some great references regarding religion, you know, Peter's got a ton of them. You can email us at yourworldnews2010. That's yourworldnews2010@gmail.com. You know, just email us, and we've got tons of reading lists and references. We have informational listservs that we can put you on those listservs, and so every time, you know, we send out information, you know, you, from the radio promos and updates, you'll get that information. And you know, going back to Frederick Douglass, you know, at the end of that speech, he said, when the slave was drunk, the slaveholder had no fear that he would escape to the north. It was the sober, thoughtful slave who was dangerous and needed the vigilance of his master to keep him a slave.
Right.
I mean, you know, if that's not, you know, salient to today. I mean, I don't know what is. I mean, I mean, and it's so true. I mean, you keep yourself, and so even when we look at just the word drunk, you know, and using drunk as a metaphor for other things, you know, not other things outside of, you know, the spirits, the fine wines, the liquors, and all those other things. Many of us are drunk on values that we have no idea how we got them. Many of us are drunk on the media.
Yes.
We have no idea how to deconstruct these dominant narratives that are consistently fed to us. And so we allow the corporate media, which, you know, in this case, like the corporate media is about 99% white. We allow them to reshape and rebrand black people within our own communities that are saying things to us that should raise critical awareness. I mean, so you look at the Reverend Wright, who, you attended his church in Chicago, Peter.
Uh-huh.
You know, look at Reverend Wright and how so many of us allowed ourselves to be duped by this guy, you know, by the likes of Fox News and the rest of the corporate media, using that take, using a part of his speech out of context and looping it over and over and over again. We allow them, you know what I'm saying, to rebrand a leader in our community, and specifically in Chicago, that had been doing a ton of things, everything from making sure that billboards, you know, weren't targeting black and Latino children throughout Chicago, because the billboards, the cigarette companies were targeting youth of color in the billboards, and to establishing HIV AIDS testing, to going to the motherland, doing work there. I mean, he name it. I mean, he did a ton of that stuff, and we allowed the white corporate media to rebrand and define who he was. And I'll say it, I don't give a damn of, you know, how many Obamaites are listening right now. I didn't vote for Barack Obama. I voted for Cynthia McKinney. The writing was on the wall. The writing was on the wall at that time. And since we're talking about Christianity, I think it's because I wrote a piece some time ago called Obamaninity, the religion of complicity. And so many of us, you know, just following Obama and everything he did and just accepting and just taking up for him no matter what he did, no matter how much he ignored the plight of poor people throughout this country, you know, everywhere from during his campaign to whatever, so many people just saying, hey, you know what, I'm still going to vote for him, you know. You know, and then even now, where he's still doing that stuff, and you have still people that are intoxicated,
right?
Intoxicated on this Obama liqueur, you know. When you compare the work that he has done in comparison to the work that Reverend Wright did in the black community, you can't compare them. You can't compare them. And yeah, you're right. One person's a politician. One person is a community leader. And that's clear to anyone that spends any time reading stuff beyond, you know, National Enquirer or the Globe, you know, periodical that you see while you're waiting in line at the grocery store, or watching Fox News, or watching BET and Housewives of Atlanta, what have you, knows that this guy has pushed forth policies domestically and internationally that if you didn't know, if you were blind and you had no idea what color, you would think this dude was a conservative Democrat or just a straight up, you know, white Republican. I mean, his policies, he's continued the Bush policies in terms of the war. He continued FISA. I mean, he's, for God's sakes, he voted for FISA when he was a senator before even whatever, you know what I'm saying, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I mean, and you look right now, and now he's allowing, you know, Haitians to be deported, back to, despite the fact that the country has been, you know, especially Port-au-Prince and the areas outside of Port-au-Prince have been ravaged by the hurricane. There's cholera. Over 2,000 people have lost their lives, and he just removed the ban on the deportation of Haitians who are in ICE facilities, and now they're going to be most likely going to be deported very soon. I mean, he said that black people during the campaign shouldn't protest the murder, the illegal murder of Sean Bell. He basically said, hey, you know. And people still voted for him. I mean, this guy bumps his chest, you know, about the bombing entire Lebanon, in 2006 by Israel, and says, hey, I was one of the first Democrats to come front and center. And I know people that knew this information that, you know what I'm saying, that still went ahead and voted for him. And so this is, when I look at what Frederick Douglass said, I look at, some of us are drunk on a whole lot of stuff that we need to take that pill and wake up. And anytime, I'm trying to tell you, anytime you have the white media that is fearful of a person of color based on what they say or do, before you pass judgment, you need to look into that person, because I bet you 9 times out of 10, that person's probably doing some good work. I bet you 9 times out of 10 that person's doing some good liberation work in your community. And the reason why the white media is so fearful and white America is so fearful of him or her is because they represent an antithetical value system. They represent a threat to their so-called power, their perceived power. So even poor white folks that have little economic power, they feel like they have some kind of political power because their whiteness, you know, at their very least, puts them above a poor black person in the same kind of financial status. And I guess in America it does. It makes them, you know, they're not going to be prey to police brutality as I would be. So, we have to examine. We have to hold our leaders to better standards. And I'll end on this. And we need to start looking at at solutions orientation. We need to look at starting, it could be starting something within your apartment or your house or, you know, community center that's in your that's in your neighborhood, and getting a few friends and building from there, having community dialogues on political education or discussing critical issues, so that you and your neighbors and your community stays informed, because the corporate media, especially the corporate white America media, is not going to put our issues out there, and is definitely not going to give any kind of critical analysis of things that we need to know about. And Peter, as you know now, as I beat my fist into the hand, one of the things that jumps out at me is right now we have going on in Georgia the largest prison strike in U.S. history. And
right.
When I talk to most people, they have never heard, I didn't know about it. And I said it, you know, because it's not mentioned anywhere. MSNBC, CNN, obviously not Fox News, they're not talking about it, but this is an array of prisoners, disenfranchised folks from across the board. Some are white, some are Muslim, you know what I'm saying, some are black Muslims, some are Latino, you know, across the board, and they have decided that these conditions are inhumane within the state of Georgia, and the state of Georgia is just part of the overall prison system in America that happens to incarcerate more people per capita and by sheer number than any other country in the entire world, and it has inhumane conditions, fatty, starchy foods. You know, they're getting paid nothing. You know what I'm saying? It's slave wages. Look at the 13th Amendment, people. Slavery was not abolished. You know what I'm saying? So they use prison as a tool.
Right.
You know,
right.
Go out there. And these people said, you know what? F you, we're not going to work. We're not going to go and make your license plates. We're not going to make your Eddie Bauer jeans and shirts. We're not going to chop the meat for pigs. We're not going to make baby bassinets. Yes, people, all those things are made in prisons today. And at a very big profit. You know, I live in Maryland, and right now in Maryland, last year the prison industry in this state made $50 million off of merchandise products that were made in the prison system. And so they said, no, we're not going to. We're not going to. And I think it's a beautiful thing, Peter. I think it's a beautiful thing. But it's some of those things that we need to know about, especially black folks, because almost 50% of the people, of the 2.6 million people that are incarcerated, are black men. Black
right.
men. The fastest growing population in prisons in America are black women.
Yes.
Come on.
Yes.
They're not going to talk
yes.
about it. You know, in
no.
our show, you and I, we're not going to get picked up by CNN. Oh, Peter Fowler and Donald Collinson every Friday for 2 hours, you know, we have them. No way. The only way they do that, Peter, is if we go on there and we start to talk about superficial things. They say, oh, yeah, you guys can talk about race as long as you don't talk about institutional racism. So we want you to talk about, have people on your show, have some black
yeah.
folks on your show and ask them how many times they've been called nigger. Well,
right.
you might have some black folks to come on there that have never been called nigger, but they live in a community that's been economically depressed as long as they've lived, as long as their parents have lived, and, you know, haven't been able to get certain FHA home loans, their neighborhoods have been redlined. That's institutional racism. That's the most deleterious form of racism. No, don't talk about that. You and Peter, talk about superficial racism. Ask them how many times they've, and that if we as black people and white people and Latino people come together and put our hands together and just feel happy about each other and stop calling each other names, it will all go away. Because, Peter, they're not going to do that. Because talking about institutional racism and starting to put the gears in motion progressively to deconstructing and destroying institutional racism and white supremacy in the United States of America will in fact erode their little basis of power, which we're seeing eroding right now as America is falling in this economic crisis. One of the reasons
that they wouldn't want us to talk about institutional racism is, again, because it goes against those cardinal virtues of Americanism, of individualism. We don't think structurally in this country. We think individually. And racism is a perfect example. You know, we think we can solve racism, by individuals getting to know each other. You know, if neighbors talk to one another, and if people, just get together and treat each other nicely. You know, and Christmas is one of those times. You know, we hold Christmas out there like, well, what if why can't the Christmas spirit last all year long? You know, because, well, you know, I was in the mall shopping and we took a break and we went to Cinnabon and we shared a table with some people of a different color. Well, you know, why can't that happen all year long? Well, you know, it's because it's mythological. So
right.
I understand we have a caller.
Yeah, we do. We have a caller, and I think maybe calling from the Midwest, but we'll find out. Caller, you're on the line. Your World News.
Yeah, I am calling from the Midwest. How'd you
guess?
Yeah,
all right.
But, you know, I heard you talking about Barack Obama.
Yes,
the
we
only
were.
The only black group that I knew that had an agenda for Barack was the black farmers, and he did come through on them somewhat. Well, blacks
have no. Barely. I mean, there's more. You know what I'm saying? Barely. They deserve much more than that. And he didn't come through. The people that organized, which you know I helped out with that as well. You know, in terms of going out there and supporting the black farmers when they came into D.C. and having folks like Robert Binion and supporting him as much as I could. That came from people's work in the community. I mean, his hand was pushed.
He added that other $1.1 billion onto the with Bush. Bush had given, what, $100 million, and Brock added another $1.15 billion?
And there's about another $3.2 billion that's owed to them. But, yeah. But in terms of you're saying that, you know, black folks and people of color need to have an agenda to stick with, I totally agree. We need to have agenda. I mean, if we continue to look at presidents, whether they be black or white, and buying into this whole cult of personality and, you know, just accepting these presidents that we do or don't vote for and not having any kind of measured, consistent agenda, much like the Israel lobby has an agenda. I don't agree with, you know, the vast majority of the, if not all of the agenda of the Israel lobby, but you can say the folks at AIPAC and even the folks at the NRA, which I don't support either, they have an agenda and they have an economic basis, and every 2, 4, and 6 years they got whatever candidates, congresspeople, senators, and presidential candidates shucking and jiving for them, no matter how nefarious.
Blacks
need to
have an economic agenda also. They need to have something that's going to empower their businesses. Their businesses got to start out of the box. The hell with the racism. It's white supremacy that's your big problem. And the way to defeat that is compete against it. Why come down there in Louisiana, blacks are not drilling offshore for oil or gas? Where is the defense companies? Where is the competition against the Halliburton, the GE, and the Boeing?
It's a good question. That's a good question. Peter, do you have any comments on that?
Well, you know, you've raised some good issues. And in terms of competition, you know, I think that is a good first step. But we have to look beyond competition within the framework of a capitalist system. We've got to move towards dismantling the capitalist system. We've got to move towards moving in the direction of a socialist economy, because simply, you know, black capitalism was again one of the means of control. I mean, we're talking about Christmas as a cultural means of control. Black capitalism was also the carrot that was held out to the black community in the late 1960s, early 1970s, as a way of calming all of the uprisings. You know, it was like buy into our system and participate in capitalism, and you know that's the way to spread the wealth. Well, it's, you know, it's over 40 years, almost 50 years now, and obviously that has been exposed as a lie and a scheme. So we've got to understand that just participating in a corrupt system, i.e., capitalism, is not the answer.
So the other thing is mm-hmm. that, you know, blacks need to be, I don't know what's going on down in Atlanta, but that's the ideal place where blacks can exploit blacks. What I mean by that, provide of the consumption that black youth Atlanta. Who controls your gas marks, your gas station, your neighborhood, your stores, or probably your supermarket? Until those things should be controlled by the people community themselves. Sure, you agree to that. We not don't. You got the fresh, you got the produce to provide. You have, you know, you have countries in Africa, Nigeria, for instance, that's producing canned products that could be imported into this country. Blacks was given special classifications in 1964. You had the AGOA Act. All those things could be utilized better than what they are, in some cases not being utilized at all, whereas you can increase that economic power. Capitalism, if that's what the gameplay is, then we have to be able to play that game and get the best out of it.
Right. I appreciate your comments. You know, I would agree with you from the standpoint that we have to be more collective in our measures. You know, and I'm not big on like labels. You know, because Africans were practicing communalism and socialism well before Marx or Engels, you know, deemed it, you know, as such. But, to me, I kind of look at capitalism as almost like a serial killer. I don't negotiate with serial killers, and so I'm not, but I understand I understand what you're saying, that, you know, we live in a capitalist society and we need to find a way to work within it. I think that we need to start to educate one another in terms of what collective economics is, and we don't have to call it socialism, but looking at what collective economics is. I mean, some of my heroes come from continental Africa, where I look at Thomas Sankara, the former leader of Burkina Faso, and, you know, and he was an individual that, and one of the things he said, you know, he said, you know, neocolonization, you know, you can just look on your plate, you know, if you want an example of neocolonization. This is all the food that's on your plate has been imported. Yet we produce, you know, grains and maize and so forth. So you look at your shirt, you know, the textiles that are used to make these shirts, you know, also come from, you know, our country, from our land. We need to be producing and consuming our own products and generating. I mean, that's why you had the success when you look at the, you know, the Black Wall Street, that's not too far from, you know, where you're located, you know, that was in Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, places like Rosewood, Wilmington, North Carolina. I mean, these were very prosperous Black communities, you know, prior to the Red Summer.
A whole lot of them.
You know, and they practiced collective economics. And so,
yeah, let me ask you another question.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you back. With the new Congress coming in, and there's going to, and I think they did form a debt committee. What austerity programs, what austerities do you see going to be coming down the pipe, and just how deep are they going to cut? Do you think we're going to start seeing government workers being laid off?
Yes.
And what about the military?
Yes. I'll take a stab at that. I'll give it to Peter, because Peter just sent me an interesting article on that. That financial piece you sent me, Peter, from the Socialist Worker. But I do say, you know, it's going to get, from all indications, from, you know, from various economists, from Stiglitz to Krugman and Dean Baker, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And, you know, I think that we're definitely going to see austerity measures. But I think that before they actually hit us in the face, people are not going to see them coming, where as you look at, like, some of the pig nations, Portugal, Italy, you know, Greece, Spain, you know, Ireland, you know, where these austerity measures, people have been getting out in the streets because they've been reaping the benefits of tax dollars going towards, social projects, you know, free education, free healthcare, those types of things. And when those things are starting to be taken away, as we see with the schooling, you know, the higher prices that students in Britain are having to pay, you see they're getting out in the streets. we kind of have been accustomed to taking that. And so I'll end on this, and I'll let Peter take a stab at it. Brother, one thing that a lot of Americans, you know, should know is that 53% of all our taxes, without our consent, I mean, 53% of our taxes go to the military industry. We write, and oh gosh, forgive me for saying we, because I have no part in that, but the U.S. government has the largest military in the entire world, has spends more money militarily than pretty much the rest of the world combined together. And it's a bloated military. I mean, we have 700 military bases. The U.S. has 700 military bases throughout the globe. And you know, for us to think that that doesn't take away from public works and social projects here in the U.S., you know, we're kidding ourselves. It most quietly certainly does. Peter, what do you think?
Yeah, we're definitely going to see more austerity. In fact, that is what that commission is getting into right now. You know, they're calling themselves the Debt Commission, which is an absolute fallacy. They came up with 10 conclusions. The conclusion number 10 was how to address the budget deficit, which is you know, ostensibly the reason they were formed. So it's a total sham. And really what that group is, and if you look at who the leaders of that group are, I don't have the names of the chairman in front of me, but they're all neoliberal, aristocratic, and they they're the ones who've been pushing for these austerity measures for a long time, even though they haven't been called austerity measures until very recently. But some of the things we're going to see is the Social Security, that they've been wanting to cut that for a long time. That's part of the neoliberal plan. You know, the neoconservatives, part of the documentation that they started to develop, 10, 15 years ago was to do away with the Social Security Administration. One of the things that this group is planning on doing is extending the age of retirement to 69 or 70. Now, we know that most blue-collar workers don't live as old, they don't live as long, as white-collar wealthy folks do. You know, so what we're going to see is people who work all their lives and are entitled to Social Security, they're not going to be getting any of that. In terms of layoffs, yeah, I mean, there's nothing in this economy that is creating jobs. Solomon, you mentioned Stiglitz. You read some of Stiglitz's things and some of the other progressive economists. You know, they'll demonstrate, their research demonstrates there's no new jobs being created. And the ones, the few that are being created, is part-time work, no benefits. The other thing that's devastating about that, even when new jobs are created, is that they're non-union jobs. We don't have unions. We don't have union solidarity like we used to, and that's that. The number of individuals and the percentage of people in unions is a fraction of what it used to be. Now, when you talk about the military, no, there won't be any layoffs in the military. Solomon, you're right. 53% out of every tax dollar goes to the military. Now, if we do see government jobs, being minimized, it's not that those jobs are going to be lost. What we're seeing is already in the military, and it's going to continue in the military, and it's going to continue in other aspects of government work too. Those jobs are going to be what? Privatized. You have these mercenary corporations now, so we have soldiers who are not being paid by the United States government, but they're being paid, by their private corporation. Now, of course, the funding for that corporation comes from the government, but nevertheless, it's privatization. So we're going to see a further privatization of government jobs. And one area that we can look at that's very instructive, is what's happening with public education right now. What's happening with public schools and the move for developing charter schools and for crushing the unions and for all the measures against teachers and education. I think that's what we're going to see developing from here on out. But we're running low on time, so I'll stop with that. Caller, we appreciate your call. Appreciate your questions.
Thank you so much, caller.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and real quick, if I could, them teachers, that's an oxymoron. Teacher unions have went against the parents, the community, the local concerns as to what they should be doing in schools. But I guess that's a whole different a whole nother program. But I agree with you on the austerity measures. And what would you suggest to people? You know, I always tell them that, one, you should try to get out as much debt as you possibly can. You need to start a home garden and also start a business that's providing something that somebody needs. Thank you very much.
All right, no problem. Thank you. One of the things, I'll take a stab at it quick. We got 5 minutes. First and foremost, caller, I would invite you to do some more research. Teachers unions are not the problem. Teachers unions are not the problem whatsoever. It is the hierarchy within education, and I'm going to give you a good reference. Go to www.dailycensored. That's censored with a C. censored.com. Go to dailycensored.com and then type in Danny Weil. His last name is Weil, and he is by far one of the most progressive and thorough journalists in this country that focuses on education reform. And he's done a lot of work. Teachers unions are under attack. Teachers unions are doing what they're supposed to do. They're protecting their interests. I mean, there's a lot of great teachers out there. Yeah, there's some bad teachers out there. There's some bad politicians out there. There's some bad administrators out there. And there's a lot of good teachers that I have met, you know, through a lot of the work I've done in terms of educational consulting is that a lot of teachers, they are, you know, based on, you could say, the austerity measures within their schools and their system, their hands are tied. In terms of being creative in the classroom, they're handed these prepackaged curriculums. Education, public education, was an attack, and it's specifically in black and brown communities that they're pushing this whole charter school notion that Peter is talking about. And the two individuals that created charter school idea in the late 80s, 86, 87, 88, they are deceased, one of them is deceased, and he'd be rolling in his grave. Charter schools were not supposed to compete. We're not designed to compete with public schools. Charter schools were supposed to augment them, all right? We're supposed to augment them. But now charter schools are pitted against public schools. And I'll give you the stat here. The Stanford study and the Harvard study showed that 77% of the time public schools outperform charter schools, 77% of the time. And everything that people say that you can do in charter schools, if public schools and teachers within public schools were given the support in terms of pay, have their tenure restored, you would see a totally, I mean, there's no reason why they can't have that same creativity in the classroom. And look through our archive. I mean, like I said, caller, if you email us at yourworldnews2010@gmail.com, I'll send you the link to the interview that I did with Danny Weil, and you can listen to that. Just really quickly on your other question, your other question, and I'll let Peter have the last word. But what I would say right now, while we're living in this epicenter of capitalism, which has become a living hell for so many people, so many workers, is, I mean, those of us that can, and some people, they can't spare, you know, a dollar or what have you. But I would, you know, ask people, you know, encourage people to start to put aside money. You know, if you get paid $100, just given a nice round number, you know, start to put aside some money in like an escrow kind of bank account, you know, whether it's $5 a week or what have you. It adds up because the storm is coming, the maelstrom is coming, and if we're not prepared, we need to prepare for that. As long as we're living in the U.S., we need to prepare for that big time, because it is coming, and those austerity measures are going to hit, and they're going to hit hard. And they're going to affect a lot of people. And you know, the question is how many of us are going to be willing to get out in the street and to do what we see is going on in other countries, go out there and protest and demanding better benefits. Peter, I'll let you have the last word. We have about 75 seconds left.
Great, thanks, Solomon. You know, if we could only mobilize and organize and then act with half the energy and enthusiasm that we show around this time of year with regard to Christmas shopping and putting up decorations and putting up lights and going through the ridiculous motions of this fraudulent holiday, we'd probably be able to change the world. And so I just want to end with another note on Christmas, to kind of round out the conversation, you know, that for folks that are listening, you know, do your research. Understand that Christmas is more about Americanism and it's more about capitalism than it is about Christianity, and it certainly isn't about Jesus, the historical Jesus, in by any stretch of the imagination. So we need to deconstruct that holiday, find another way to express your spirituality, and to reconnect with transcendent reality, because there is a transcendent reality, and I wish we'd had some more time to have gotten into to that. So, Merry, happy holiday season to everybody. Thanks, Solomon.
Right. Peace and unrest.
Peace and unrest.
All right.